Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply. How you doing tonight, Eric?
Fine, Justin. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. My mind is swirling this week with all the research I've done, so I hope that I am coherent with regurgitating and trying to storytell.
This is our 5th anniversary. June 2012 is when Justin and I started the podcast. Basically, at his behest, he asked, you know, we need to record my thoughts somehow on some of this stuff, and that's where the podcast came from. But I really wanted us to go back and cover one of the cases we'd covered long ago, but cover it now and cover it in the more structured way that we do things. And Justin had a topic ready. He said, I want to talk about Bob Berdella, a.k.a. the Butcher of Kansas City.
We did cover this before, but in most of our earlier episodes, and I know you guys love them and you don't like it when we take some of them down, but we really feel like a lot of them just lack quality and we could do better. So most of the time, 99% of the time, when we take something down, it's because we plan on redoing it. So it'll be better. 5 years. And anytime we talk about how we started, I always want to try to give you more credit. You know, I'm the idea guy and you're the execution guy.
Yeah, well, we work well as a team, I think. But yeah, 5 years, it's pretty special. We will be doing something special here in our hometown of Kansas City. We're planning a meetup in October.
Should we not say the location?
Yeah, tell them where.
Meetup, appropriately, will be at the Westport Flea Market, where tonight's case has a tie to.
And I want to thank all of the Patreon supporters. They've really been on my mind lately. We've gotten, I don't know how many messages we've gotten or posts, but just a bunch of them telling us how much they appreciate us. Well, yeah, back at you. We appreciate all that you guys do for us. So thank you very much.
And I've even read a few messages where people say, I'm sorry, I'm broke. I wish I could support. Hey, don't feel bad. I want you to eat, feed your kids. I don't want you giving us money if it's going to put you in financial harm. So do not feel bad. We love you regardless.
As we talked about, Justin has really wanted to cover this case again, the case of Robert Berdella. At the beginning here, I want to point out that many people haven't heard of this serial killer because right around the same time, I'd say not that long after, another killer was captured, and that was Jeffrey Dahmer. And Jeffrey Dahmer literally took over the media.
I don't know all the details, but I remember it in the news, and he was a horrible guy. What sets Robert Berdella apart from Jeffrey Dahmer is Bob would do horrible things to his victims while they were alive. Whereas Jeffrey, a lot of his heinous acts were after they were dead. I think the brutality of torture holds much more weight as opposed to cannibalism and other things that Jeffrey did. I'm sure there would be a great debate about that, but we're going to get into the details here. So forewarning, normally we try to water things down. I know on the Richard Ramirez case, I did my best to spare you from a lot of the details. It's impossible to do that on this one. This is not for children. There's going to be some really graphic stuff here. If you're at work, put on the headphones. Can't get around it. Sorry about that. Kansas City, starting in the 1970s and on into the 1980s, suffering from the crack epidemic and the inception of street gangs. Kansas City, Missouri, believe it or not, typically makes the top five most violent city in the nation. It's because of the per capita murders here. We might not have a lot of people, but we have a lot of murder. And this upward spike in violence will start in the 1970s and actually go all the way up into the mid-90s. But in the 1980s, it was pretty bad. The downtown, midtown area of Kansas City was a no-go zone for a lot of people. The gay community was not accepted at that time. Gay bashing, vandalism to gay bars was nonstop. It was really a harsh time. 1980s were a completely different world. There were a few areas of Kansas City where men would go and be picked up in cars by other men for sex and money. Hotspot was down at 10th and McGee. Chris Bryson, 22, he's out and about and looking for something to get into, whether that be a party, drinking, whatever it is. He's picked up by a man in a Toyota Tercel. Tuesday morning, March 29th, 1988. The man driving the car will be Bob Berdella. He will ask Chris if he wants a beer. There's beer in the back seat. And Chris will ask him, you know, what are you doing tonight? And Bob will say, I'm looking to party. And Chris will think, well, that's kind of cool because he could maybe just go drink and do drugs this night and not have to engage in any kind of sex or anything like that. Bob will inform Chris that he has Valium and other sedatives back at his house, and that they could go back there. Bryson actually doesn't think Bob is gay. He says he doesn't come off that way. But Bryson will commit to going back to his house, and at that point he sort of figures, okay, maybe this is a married guy or something to that effect that wants to do something on the side with me. They drive to 4315 Charlotte Street. They go inside and Bob gives him more beer and some drugs. They're sitting in the downstairs area, but Bob says, I have these two ferocious dogs and they're going to be barking a lot and whatnot, and they're not real friendly, so we should go upstairs. I have a couch and a TV set up there, so let's just move the party up there, and Bryson's okay with that.
Yeah, the dogs that Berdella had were chows.
Chows have a bad reputation, but I had a chow mix once, and he was sweet as could be.
Yeah, my family had a chow before, and they very friendly dog. Purple Tongue.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I remember about it.
Something Chris notices right off the bat in the house is the smell. It smelled of rotting food, dog feces, and it was cluttered like a hoarder's house. There's just stuff everywhere, stacked. So moving through the house was not easy, and they start moving up the stairs. Once they reach the top of the stairs, Bryson is hit from behind, and he falls to the floor. Bryson feels a stick to the back of his neck, and we can only assume that he's being injected with something. Bob drags Bryson into a bedroom and puts him in a chair and then takes a photo of him with his Polaroid camera.
Now, Polaroid cameras, for some of you who don't know what those are, it was a type of camera that would spit out the picture and then, you know, people would wave it a little bit and then the picture would develop right in front of you.
It was like magic. He dragged Bryson into the bedroom and laid him on the bed. He used bathrobe sashes to tie his hands and knotted around his legs. He will put a washcloth in his mouth and use a thin cord to create a gag. He finishes by putting a dog collar on him and a leash, which he ties to the bedpost as well. At 5:30 a.m., Bob will re-enter the room with a notebook and start jotting things down, taking notes.
Bob was keeping a diary, but his diary is actually loose papers that he writes on. And he uses a combination of photographs and diary entries to document what he does to his victims.
At 5:30 to 6 a.m., he writes FRTFU finger. And this is after he has sexually assaulted Bryson. At 7:30 a.m., Bob injects him again, and he writes down the amount and what he's injecting him with, which is animal tranquilizer. At 8 a.m., Bryson will regain consciousness. He'll feel the gag in his mouth, and he can't really breathe because he just says he breathes through his mouth. He doesn't breathe through his nose, so he's in a panic because, well, he's tied to a bed and he can't breathe. He's trying to look around the room, and Bob will walk in and jab his finger into Bryson's eye. Bob will leave, return to the room with some utensils, and he'll have a cotton tip swab that he'll dip in bleach or ammonia, and he will swab Bryson's eyes with this and try to blind him. Bryson struggled, but he can't get away. He's just tied down. Bob climbs on top of him and just starts beating him with this metal pipe again. After the beating, he hooks metal alligator clamps to his leg and genitals and sends electric shocks into Bryson.
Now, do you know how much electricity he sends into his body?
7,700 volts. With each jolt, whole body is becoming rigid, flopping around the bed, and these are jolts to his genitals.
And meanwhile, Bob photographs this.
Yeah. After he administers these shocks, he will give him more injections of the tranquilizer. He will shoot Bryson in the neck with drain cleaner, and he's injecting this into his voice box or his vocal cords to deaden them so Bryson cannot scream or yell.
Well, that's his intention anyway.
Yeah.
And what this reminded me of, you know, when you think about the kind of torture he's putting him through, this sounds like something out of a Nazi concentration camp.
Horrible things. At 11:45, Bob has written quiet, and he ends up injecting Bryson with 5 cubic centimeters of the tranquilizer. normally he's injecting 1 to 2, but now he's doing larger quantities. At 3:30 in the afternoon, Bob returns to the room. He injects Bryson with penicillin, which is a little odd, but apparently he wants to make sure that Bryson doesn't get infections. Bryson's moaning, starting to try to call out for help, and Bob will command him to shut up. And he will then go on to anally rape Bryson. He tells him, "Do not fight me, or you'll get more of what you got earlier," referring to the electric shocks and beatings that he's already endured. Bob will tell him, "You see, what you got is nothing compared to what you have. You must ask for permission to speak by placing your hand on your mouth. And if I touch you on the head, then you may talk. If you do not, I will smack you with an iron bar." Bob says, "You did not choose to be here, but you are. For you to survive being here, and for you to make it, it could either be rough or it can be easy. If I grow to like you and trust you, then I could do special things for you, such as buy you cigarettes or pick up a movie on my way home. The only way you can harm me is with your arms and your teeth. I can make it so that you can never use your arms again, and I will surely take care of your teeth. Try to escape, and I will kill you. You will be dead." Bryson thought about escaping, but even if he was able to get out of his bonds and get out of this room, he knew that there were two vicious dogs waiting for him downstairs. He also could not see the window in the room he was in. He didn't know what floor he was on or anything because he's so disoriented. He's really trying to show Bryson that he is in control and Bryson is now his captive partner.
So at this point, you should realize what Bob Riddella is.
He's a sick individual.
Right. But he's a sexual psychopath.
That's an understatement. Bob will continue the shocks and rape. Also will bring him cigarettes and other items. Each morning, Bob would place Bryson on his back, tie his feet together, tie his hands to the bedposts, put the wash gag over Bryson's mouth. Before leaving the room, he would switch on a television for Bryson to watch, but he would turn the volume up really loud so Bryson wouldn't be able to hear when he was coming or going. By Thursday, Bob and Bryson are actually communicating, and Bob says, "I've gotten this far with other people before, but they're dead now because of mistakes they made. Mistakes included not asking Bob for permission to speak or resisting his advances." Bryson told Bob that he felt feverish. He might be getting sick. Bob will go out and come home with the Lost Boys movie and RoboCop and cigarettes and give Bryson more penicillin. Bob would allow Bryson to go to the bathroom, but he would make sure that his hands were bound and he had the collar and dog leash for control. By Friday, Bryson is playing with the knots. He's trying to figure out how to get them off of his hands. He waits for Bob to leave, and then he waits hours longer to make sure he's gone, and then he'll loosen the knots and see how far he can get. He asked for permission to speak because his hands are tied above his head to the headboard, you know, the posts on the bed. And he asked Bob, "Can you tie me in a different way? Because my arms are falling asleep. They're going numb and I cannot move them. And it's very painful." On Friday, Bob obliges and says, "Okay." And he ties them in front of Bryson. And that's where he can really play around with the knots and try to figure out if he could get away.
But didn't he also see something in the room that he might be able to use to free himself?
Bob would bring him cigarettes and he would use matches to light them. Well, Bob left the book of matches by mistake. And Bryson kept his eyes on that book because that's what he was going to use to burn his way out of this place or just set the place on fire because he was that desperate.
His bindings should be able to be destroyed with the flame from a match.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out. This happened to be Easter weekend, and it happened to be Final Four in Kansas City.
The Final Four teams in the college basketball championships.
I have no idea. I don't watch college basketball, but it's a huge thing, and it's big time in Kansas City. The teams would come through. You know, we have KU, and
that's it.
Yeah.
We just have KU.
Bryson will ask Bob if he can leave the TV on so he can watch the Final Four, and if he can tie his arms in front of him on that Saturday.
Bob is agreeing to do things the way Bryson's asking him to because he figures if I appease him a little bit, then he'll be easier to keep.
And he'll be more passive with me. So when I'm raping him, he won't fight as much, or I won't have to drug him as much. Saturday morning, Bob left the house to go to his shop, which we'll go into that later. Bryson gets his wrists free. It takes him about 20 minutes to get his hands free. And he is afraid to touch the metal posts on the bed because he thinks Bob has booby-trapped the room. He thinks that he might get an electric shock if he touches anything metal. He doesn't trust anything. So he takes the book of matches and he starts burning the ropes that are tied around his legs to free himself. So he's lighting a match, lighting the rope on fire, but before the rope can burn him, he's putting it out, lighting another match, lighting the rope on fire again, and slowly burning through this, all the while thinking this man is going to walk back in at any moment and see what he's doing and kill him. He gets through all the ropes. He listens. He does not hear any noise. He pulled the gag out of his mouth. He doesn't even know where his clothes are. All he has is a dog collar around his throat. There's a pitcher in front of the window. He tosses that aside. He doesn't think the window is going to open. He just assumes that it's either painted closed or Bob has nailed it shut.
or I believe all of the windows in the house are covered by something, either a curtain, drapes, or in that case, a picture. But all of the windows are kind of covered, so people can't just look into Bob's home.
He opened the window, crawled out, and he's trying to drop into the neighbor's yard. So he's hanging on to the gutter, trying to swing out. But the gutter rips off, and he just falls straight down. And I think he ends up fracturing his foot pretty bad.
Now, he has to do this because, well, Bob Berdella has two chows. And those two dogs might just attack him. And in fact, he believes they will attack him if he goes down there. So the window was his only option in his mind. As you said, the room's booby-trapped. The dogs are in the house. This is his only means of escape. Of course, until he opens the window, he didn't even know that he was on the second floor.
Bryson walks across the street, and he sees a meter man named Felix Duran. And he screams at him. He's like, call the police, help me. The meter man will actually walk him up to another house that's across the street and sit him down on the porch while the neighbors will call law enforcement. The first two responding officers that arrive have a slightly dismissive attitude towards this. They think this guy's a madman. They think, oh, this is another gay bondage thing gone awry. But they're there to talk to him, and he says that this man has held him captive in his home for the last 5 days and has been raping him. They will take the time to call in to the sex crime unit and call in another investigator, but they really don't know what to make of it, and they think the whole thing's going to blow over. They really don't take it that serious yet.
Which seems crazy because the guy is standing there naked wearing a dog collar.
Yeah.
And he's obviously injured his leg pretty badly due to jumping out of a second story window.
They ask him to tell the story, and he will say that he was hitchhiking and a man and a woman picked him up in a car because he doesn't want them to know that he was getting in a car with a man. He doesn't want them to know that he was doing sex acts for money. He's trying to protect himself a little bit, and he knows that they won't take him that seriously if they find out that he's doing criminal acts. So he's lying to protect himself, but then giving them all the information of what's happening to him in this house. He's telling them that he was given electric shocks, that he was being injected. There was a little serving tray next to the bed that had syringes on it. He gives them a lot of details.
So at some point they realize, wait a minute, a crime has happened.
They call in Officer Cole, who's one of the lead investigators that go with this case. And Cole also has a somewhat dismissive attitude in the beginning. It's very reminiscent to me of the situation that happened with one of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims that escaped, made it to the police, but he had a language barrier and they gave him back to Jeffrey. Now, I already knew this story, but I truly was on the edge of my seat reading the book thinking, are they not going to take this seriously? Are they going to give him back to Bob? Are they? All of a sudden, I was like, I went stupid and didn't remember the story and that this guy was the one that escaped. Cole will take it very seriously. He will give Bryce a blanket to cover him and take him down to the station to take a more official statement. Right now, all they have is a sexual assault charge, and it's Easter weekend. They're trying to figure out if they need to address this right now or if it's something that could wait till Monday, but they actually do their job. And Cole takes the reins and he says, we need to place some officers out there because this guy kind of sounds like a sicko. Later that day, they will speak to a judge who will give them search warrants, which I'm glad that they're going through the right process here. I'm glad that they're following the right channels. Personally, I think they had plenty of probable cause to enter the home for somebody reporting a sexual assault, but they don't. They actually go and get a search warrant. Cole will bring in other officers from different, I guess, different departments or sections. He'll bring in an investigator from robbery, an investigator from the sex crimes unit, and he'll also bring in a man named Sergeant Orth. Now, here's a little 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon. In high school, I was good friends with Keenan Nichols, who went on to be a famous guitar player for a bunch of bands, and he was dating Shannon Orth, the daughter of Sergeant Orth. And that's actually the first time I heard about this case, was her telling me, yeah, my dad, he was the lead investigator on the Bob Berdella case. Cole is still having somewhat of doubts about this and thinking it might just be a lover's quarrel gone awry. Thank God Sergeant Orth was there. He walks into the house, sees the disarray, and they start going through items. They're looking for the room that Bryson had described. They're not finding it. They're going through the downstairs, the upstairs, and then they finally come across a room that seems to be slightly barricaded, and they know now that they've found the area. And they go into the room, they see the bed, they see the burned ropes on the ground, they see the TV, they see the serving tray with the syringes, and Orth's spidey sense is kicking. They find photographs of Bryson, and they also find bags of photographs of other men that look to be in bondage, in pain, and one of them is hanging upside down with great discoloration in his skin and appears to be dead.
There are a total of 19 different men in these well over 200 photographs.
That's scary stuff. Some of the photos are them engaged in sexual acts, some of them in somewhat consensual sexual acts, and others of them tied down with bags over their heads.
With syringes in their backs.
Yeah. Orth is thinking this could be a homicide. He's really pulling the trigger on, we need to do something here. We need to move on this guy.
So they're moving through the house. They've realized now they probably have a criminal on their hands, if not a murderer. And in Bob Berdella's room, inside of a closet, they discover a skull and an envelope containing teeth.
They find other skulls, but they're not sure if these are real or not. So they have to call up a anthropology professor from a college. Again, Easter weekend, it's hard to get a hold of people.
But I believe they know that at least one of them is real. One of them could very well be a murder victim. Investigators are all over Bob Berdella's home, in his yard. And meanwhile, Bob Berdella is working at the flea market. He has his shop that he runs, Bob's Bizarre Bazaar.
It's an oddities and ethnic items shop, I guess.
Right. Artifacts from around the world, Roman, Egyptian, items that are occult related. Because of the NCAA basketball championship that was going on at the time, Bob had placed four skulls out in plain view, and it said the final four.
Now, these skulls were not his victim's skulls. They were not. I don't even think they were real skulls. I think they were replicas, but this is his sick sense of humor.
He hears that police are all over his house, all over his property.
His neighbor actually calls him and tells him, hey, cops are at your house.
So what does Bob do? Bob gets in his car and he drives home.
Like what? I mean, that's so ironic, but he kind of figured the gig was up.
So Bob doesn't run. He goes and asks the police, what's up? And then from there on, at least for a while, Bob, he just shuts up and he asks for a lawyer.
Sergeant Orth and Cole will see some flower beds out in the back, about the size of a grave. and one of them has been turned up recently. They call the city to get a backhoe brought in, and they know that if they can't get the backhoe brought in, they're going to just start digging with shovels. It is not that hot outside, but it's hot enough that they don't want to exert themselves too much. So within a day of a sexual assault report, they're bringing in a backhoe. I have to applaud them because initially it appears that they were going to disregard this and hope that it blew over. But Cole's still kind of on the fence of, is this just weird bondage stuff and a weird guy? He runs an oddity shop, so he has weird stuff all over the place. He has a whole room that's just all these items that he sells in his shop, along with books about the occult and witchcraft and whatnot. But Orth is definitely taking it for what it is, and he thinks that there is a more serious crime at hand. The backhoe got its first scoop. They went through it, didn't find anything. Second scoop, they see what appears to be a human head.
And there's a vertebrae still attached to it.
There's no denying what this is. There's still flesh on it.
They took another scoop before that, and they were coming up with animal bones. They were clearly animal bones, not human. But yes, when this skull came out of the ground, it really got their attention.
Back inside the house, the officers are having to divide up and be assigned one officer per room to start categorizing things because it's just such a mess. Also, by the end of the day, they're wearing booties for their shoes, paper suits, and HEPA masks because it's disgusting. This is 1988. AIDS is at an all-time high. They feel like they prick their hands on a syringe, or they even inhale. You know, the amount of education on AIDS and AIDS awareness was pretty low. The cops are paranoid, and they're taking extra precautions now. But the house is a disaster and disgusting anyway, so I think their precautions are justified. From the Polaroid of the man hanging upside down, they will go down into the basement, and that will be the location where this photo was taken. There is a drain on the floor. There is blood droplets on the walls and some of the legs. Blood spatter on dog food bags.
And not surprisingly, when they put down luminol to detect blood that you can't see, it really flares up. There has been a large amount of blood on the floor. There's one more item they find at the house that I want to mention, and that's that they find a chainsaw. And the chainsaw appears as if it may have been used to cut up a body. They have it forensically tested, and sure enough, it's been used to
cut flesh.
To cut flesh. Now, what this means is they've gone through the house, they've gone through the backyard, they've found at least two human skulls. They found those teeth. They find the photographs, and they find the diary entries that we mentioned earlier, but they're not finding bodies.
This is different from what they're used to. Kansas City used to be a heavy mob town, and with the gangs and the crime that's happening, they're always used to having a body but no suspect. But in this case, they have a suspect, but they have no bodies.
This is crazy, though, because this isn't the first time that police have interacted with Robert Berdella. In the mid-80s, a couple of different men had gone missing. A man by the name of Jerry Howell went missing July of 84, and James Ferris went missing September of 1985. And a witness came forward by the name of Todd Stoops, who told the police, hey, there's a guy that I saw both those missing people with, and that's Robert Berdella. So the police went and spoke with Mr. Berdella, and not only did they talk to him, but then they watched him. They tailed him. and they would visit his shop. They would ask him questions. He told them, yeah, I know those guys, but he had stories. He would say, well, I dropped that one guy off that day he went missing. I dropped him off at the 7-Eleven. And yes, I saw the other guy. We hung out. He denied any involvement in their disappearances because the police, I guess, didn't have any more information and they didn't catch him doing anything. They let him go.
And Bob did have lots of interactions with people between his shop and the nomadic gay community that would come and go. He would help a lot of these younger men. He would let them stay at his house. He would give them drugs and alcohol because that was how you would attract younger men that want to party. He would give them money. He would do things for them. They were always coming and going. He felt himself a semi-mentor to a lot of these younger men, a lot of these younger gay men.
But they weren't all gay men. Some of these young guys just wanted drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they needed a place to stay.
And Bob was more than willing to let them into his home, give them jobs around his property, have them mow his yard, clean up stuff because, well, his house was a mess. This was just well known. And a lot of members of the gay community actually liked him a lot because he did do some good things.
And as you said, back then, there was a lot of animosity towards the gay community. But with Bob, it was my home is your home.
Yeah.
How did he get some of these men to his home?
He mostly would pick them up from these hot spots where they would hang out, or he would meet them through friends of friends. It's alleged that Judge Walsh had ordered younger men to go be mentored by Berdella in some sort of drug rehab situation where Bob had claimed to be a neighborhood mentor for these young men. But when Judge Walsh has been questioned about this, she denies that there was ever an order for this. But there's this claim that even the city was sending men his way for rehabilitation. But I could not verify that. It's really just an allegation at this point. They tell Bob, a man has accused you of sexual assault. Bob says, what's his name? They say, Chris. Bob asks, what's his last name? And the investigators don't want to tell him. They say, that's none of your business. Bob says, well, then that's all I really have to say to you. I want to talk to my lawyer now. Give me my phone call. Bob lawyers up. I mean, I hate to say it, but he is doing what people should do. And he will not talk to the police. He will not talk to anybody except his lawyer. The police have to charge Bob within 24 hours of holding him. And otherwise, they have to let him go. Or they have to set bond or a bail. They have to scramble over Easter to get all of this information documented and take it to a judge on Easter and wake a judge up. I think it's actually Monday morning, and get him to sign off on all this stuff. And the judge will look at it, realize what a disgusting world we live in, and set no bond, no bail. What are some of those charges?
In the notes that Bob documented his crimes in, he didn't list the names of the people he was torturing. So they had to figure out who these people were. Who were the victims? They didn't have bodies. They had two skulls. So this was a lot of work, as Justin's talking about, with the 24-hour period. They had to make every second count. So what they did was they charged him in the death of Larry Pearson. And Bob was at an arraignment for this, and he pled guilty, which was a bit strange because at the arraignment, they basically are supposed to list the charges, but people don't usually come out and say, I'm guilty.
This is really screwed up too, because the investigators were not able to get a hold of Bryson, because Bryson would just take off. I mean, the guy's been abducted, tortured for a week. He's going back out on the streets. He doesn't know what to do with himself. They tried to get him into a rehab, but on the day of the arraignment, the only survivor witness they have is Bryson, and he doesn't show. And they're thinking, well, we don't have the sodomy charge anymore. All we have is a murder charge, you know, and it's a little shaky. This could go badly.
They're thinking we may not be successful here at this arraignment. They're not feeling very confident. So when Bob just says that he's guilty, to me, that's a lucky break.
Bob actually did this intentionally on behalf of his lawyers, who told him, you can get the death penalty, but they haven't filed for it yet. So if you put in a guilty plea, they can't get you with the death penalty.
It's an automatic sentence of life.
Yeah. So this was very intentional, his guilty plea.
Yes, but okay. To me, it's very tricky because if they didn't get him saying I'm guilty, then this could be a shaky case, right? They don't have any bodies.
Bob saw the writing on the wall. He didn't realize how shaky of a case it was. He just figured, they got me. This is going to happen. And he's playing damage control. But they've only charged him with this one murder. They haven't charged him with the others. And the prosecutors can absolutely go for the death penalty on these other ones. So that's why sometimes you see these prosecutors not charge somebody with all of the crimes or all of the murders, because they're keeping an ace in their back pocket. And they can charge him with the death penalty on another. And then they have negotiation power to find the bodies, or they have weight to deal with this person to get more information about their crimes.
Right. Leverage. There's another arraignment later where they charge him for the death of Robert Sheldon. But at this arraignment, Bob enters a plea of not guilty. But even though he says not guilty, it doesn't take very long at all before Bob and his lawyers are talking, and then let's strike a deal. Yeah. So they approach the prosecutors and say, look, just guarantee me life in prison and I will give you everything you want to know about these crimes. And I mean, they say that the prosecutors are going to agree to this, or the prosecutors agreed to this because the families need answers. They want to know what happened to these young men. Only Bob Berdella can give them those answers. And he's holding some cards still. As we said, all they have are the diaries. There aren't names attached to these entries. They do have pictures. So they know that these people were with Bob Berdella and that he likely killed them. But it's his confession where they learn the horrible truth about what went on in Berdella's home.
And who all the victims were. Because right now they only have two besides Bryce.
So the new charges with this deal that they strike, Larry Pearson, as well as four others, are all second degree murder charges. In the death of Robert Sheldon, they give him a charge of first degree murder.
I think it's odd that they're going for the second degree, but again, this is all plea bargains and negotiations between the prosecution and defense. But the prosecution, they were worried that they weren't going to be able to get a conviction because they didn't have cause of death. They didn't have a lot of information here. Without all of this, it's hard to do, but we're sitting here, hindsight 2020. Dude's a serial killer. You found a human head in his backyard. Come on.
But they don't know what killed him.
No.
So when they look at this victim, they see a skull, but then they don't have the information they need to say, here's how he did it. Now, the diaries do contain information. As we warned you about, Bob Berdella tortured his victims. What he did to these poor men is pretty disgusting.
He had acronyms that he used in his notes. F will always stand for the F word. So he has CF, which means carrot. He has cuck F, which means cucumber. He has FF, which means fist. He has FRF, which means friction or front. He has EKG, which means shock. He has PIN, which is penicillin. and he has a PH for pharmaceutical or injections of sedatives. He used piano wire as gags and as bonds for the hands. Piano wire would cut into their wrists. So even if they got free, their hands were useless. He would put caulking in their ears to prevent them from hearing. He would put drain cleaner in their eyes. He would shoot drain cleaner into their voice box. Just an onslaught of injections and tranquilizers. He would also use the needles to just hit them in pain points on their body, whether it be under the fingernails or in their eyes or in their genitals.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Well, I had said before that he was a sexual psychopath, and this is a person who has an uninhibited aggressive sexuality where their power over their victims turns them on. And this puts that victim in great harm. This is why so many victims die, is because the sexual psychopath will objectify their victims. And in his diaries, he never names the victims. So he's objectifying them. They're not people to him. They're playthings.
He refers to them as sex dolls or clay dolls, things that he can mold, things that he can manipulate, things that are inhuman. The investigators are wondering, where are all the bodies? And it's not until his confession that they learn what he would do to these men. He would hang them from either the rafters in the basement, or he would put them in a bathtub upstairs, and he would make incisions all over their body to drain the blood out. He would use a knife to cut the joints, and then he would use the chainsaw to go through the bone and to decapitate them. He would wrap the parts in a newspaper, put the parts in the dog food bags, and then put those in garbage bags and leave them for the trash man to pick up. He would watch as the trash man would come in the morning and pick it up. Some people don't believe that he would be able to get away with this because dogs in the neighborhood or there would be a smell, but he would take the trash out right before the trash man would get there. He wouldn't leave it out all night, so it's doable. The first head that they found inside the house, he had actually buried out in the backyard. And then when he decapitated his second victim, he took that head out there, dug up the first one, buried the second one. It's just weird stuff. He kept the one in the freezer for a while. At one point, Bob had the end of his penis bitten off, and he had to go to the ER to have it reattached. The ER nurse will actually show up on a documentary later. She claims that this happened multiple times over the course of a few years that he had to have the head of his penis reattached. I can only confirm one time, but you can imagine how it was bitten off or what happened there. It's a whole other level of disgusting. I haven't had to really engage with a lot of the other serial killers we study.
It's very likely that his victims were fighting back when they had an opportunity to do so. To give you an example, one of his victims had their hands broken so that they couldn't do much. And perhaps biting Bob on his penis was about the only defense some of these victims had.
He would put these gags in their mouth and then inject them with huge amounts of tranquilizers.
Some of them would be asphyxiated.
When they would vomit or just could not breathe under these conditions.
Well, and one time there was a man working on Bob's roof, and he got a little nervous about that, worried that man might find out that he had someone captive in his home. So he put a bag over the victim's head and secured it. That man died by asphyxiation.
Yeah, he just would slowly suffocate with this bag. The man that worked on his roof, he was supposed to have been there weeks or months before, and Bob just forgot about it. But the guy shows up randomly when he has a captive. Even with the caulking in their ears or the bleach and Drano in their eyes and the drain cleaner in their vocal cords, but he still was concerned that they could alert others or escape. It's very odd to me that he would tie Bryson's hands in front of him. He must have really liked Bryson.
Now, because of the investigation, because of Bob's confession, we know a lot more now about what happened to these young men.
And who they were.
And who they were. They are Jerry Howell, who was age 20 at the time, 1984.
He was held for about a week or 40 hours.
And depending upon the cooperative nature of the victim, that would go a long way towards determining how long they survived in his house.
Yeah.
Robert Sheldon, age 18, 1984.
He had met Sheldon at a drug research facility. He would survive for 72 hours going off of the notes.
Mark Wallace, age 20, 1985. Wallace became a victim of Berdella when he ended up drunk in his tool shed.
It was storming out and he was seeking shelter there.
Bob had found him trying to free himself at one point, and that's when Bob Berdella started injecting him and then killed him. James Ferris, age 20, 1985.
He was held for about a day.
And he injected him with a great amount of ketamine and chlorpromazine.
All tranquilizers for the most part.
Todd Stoops, age 21, 1985. Todd Stoops and Bob Berdella met in 1984. And it was 2 years later when Stoops met his fate at the hands of Bob Berdella. In between, though, Stoops and his wife, they were around Bob here and there because they moved in a couple of times with him. And it was known that Todd was getting drugs from Bob here and there. The last time it seemed that Todd was asking Bob for money and saying that he needed Ritalin and Tolwyn. Tolwyn is a painkiller that's used before or after surgery. And Bob said, sure, I can get you those things. And he also fed him. But it's after he's eaten that Todd has been given a bunch of sedatives.
Copious amounts of sedatives laced in the food. I think Todd lasts about 2 weeks.
But it's actually early on in his captivity that he suffers an injury by Bob Berdella that will end up killing him. And there's this question, at least when you look through the notes and you hear Bob talk, did he try to save any of these young men? Now, obviously, he's a murderer, so that's not really up for debate. But some of these victims, we'll take Todd Stoops, for example, here. Bob Berdella shoved his fist into Stoops's rectum, and this would cause him an injury that would get worse and worse. It would become infected.
It would rupture his lining, and you're dumping your waste into your body cavity. I'm surprised. Most people will only live hours if this happens, but to what degree?
Well, Bob had antibiotics that had been prescribed to his chows, his dogs.
And that's actually how he got most of his drugs, is he told veterinarians, I need this for my dog because they're aggressive. I need to sedate them.
So he is giving Stoops these antibiotics, these different antibiotics, but he's not a doctor. So we have to look at the question of intention. Is he trying to save Todd Stoops? And I think he was just trying to keep him alive longer because he wasn't done with him.
That's it. It's just about all about control. He can keep him alive and control him longer.
The last man to die at the hands of Bob Berdella that we know of, Larry Pearson, age 20, 1987.
It is said that he was kept in captivity for 43 days. I can't imagine that. People will say Bob had 6 victims, and he had 7 because Christopher Bryson was absolutely a victim, but he is also a survivor. He was able to attend one of the trials and actually face Bob. They gave him the option to give his testimony via a recorded testimony, but he did get his life somewhat together. But during this time, he was living on the streets. He had left his wife, cut off contact with his family, and it was very frustrating for the investigators and the prosecution because this was, in their mind, the ace in the hole.
A living witness.
Yeah. There was a interesting backlash in Kansas City when this all went down. And the events that follow Bob getting caught and tried in Kansas City are things that I don't think that the city should be proud of. There were jokes and songs made about Bob Berdella and his victims. There was a radio DJ. His name was Skid Rody, and he was at the Fox radio station. He wrote a Bob Berdella song to the harmony of Mellow Yellow. Radio stations would run contests with their listeners. They took a picture of themselves with a Polaroid wearing a dog collar, or showed up to the radio station wearing dog collars. They would get prizes.
Okay, so you and I are a little disgusted by this, but there is absolutely an audience for this kind of dark humor.
Yes, there is. I guess my problem here is, if his victims were women, would it have been different? There was outrage in the town. There were people that were disgusted, people that... This wasn't a reign of terror where they were wanting this man caught. This was out of the blue that this guy was living next door to them, and then they realized what he had been doing. But since it was male victims and mainly gay male victims, it seemed to be a big joke, and that's pretty disgusting to me. It was also disgusting to a man named Reverend Roger Coleman, who was a missionary. He just got back from Ethiopia and other places, war-torn countries. He didn't like the disgusting rhetoric going on, and he wanted to do something about it. He wanted to have a counter-narrative. He asked what he could do, and he talked to Bob Berdella's defense team and other people, and they actually told him, well, Bob happens to be suicidal, so if you want to come in and talk to him, you're more than welcome to. And for a few months, Reverend Coleman would go talk to Bob and literally get a confessional from him. This is before Bob confessed to the investigators. Coleman will say that over the course of these few months, he will lose 20 pounds, be drained, be more horrified and disturbed by the acts of Berdella than he was seeing dying children in Ethiopia. It really impacted him, and I can understand why, because just indulging in this for the last week has kind of bothered me. People would question whether or not there were more victims, and they would make the argument that serial killers get more and more, not less and less, because they were spaced out further by the end of his reign of terror. But again, this is the mid to late 80s. People hadn't realized that there's people out there like BTK who can go on hiatus for 10 or 20 years and come back. This was new ground for serial killers. During the court proceedings, there were several civil lawsuits pending against Bob, and he promised the confession if the victims would drop their lawsuits. He also promised a confession if they wouldn't go after the death penalty. He also had stipulations that he could auction off his house and his property and form even a victims fund for the families, which, that's weird.
Well, they had threatened to take his house. They had threatened to seize his house, and they were in the process of doing so.
I think this actually goes back to control. He just wanted control. And the prosecutors and whatnot actually oblige, and they don't go after the death penalty. The victims' families don't go after their civil lawsuits.
Betty Haste, who is Todd Stoops' mother, she was not going to drop a lawsuit. She sued Bob and his insurance company. The lawyers representing her in this case recommended $1 billion to the jury. The message to the jury is, you cannot allow someone like this to get away with what they've done. They need to have a message sent that this is unacceptable. They always say that you can't put a price on the loss of a family member. And so how do they represent that? $1 billion. Well, the jury in this case, they heard the billion and they raised it. The jury came up with $5 billion. Bob could only come up with about $60,000, a little over that. That's it. It's not really about paying Betty this money. It's about showing, hey, this is as best as we can describe it. This is your impact on the families. This is what your atrocities have done. This is the amount of damage.
Bob did have an auction, and he would be very controlling of this. He was engrossed in the details. He would end up firing the first organizer and hiring his defense lawyers to run it. His stuff sold out pretty quick. The auctioneers felt like they were giving the stuff away because some of the valuable items, such as a nice lamp or some crystal set, wouldn't go for very much. But anything that was related to the crimes, that stuff they got a lot more for. So it was murderabilia that people were really going after. And a rich millionaire came in and pretty much bought out the whole lot and the house, right?
Yeah, his name was Del Dunmeyer. Everybody was coming by the home to look at it. It was a painful reminder of the horrible atrocities that took place there. But for some, it was a place to go by and check out because that's where a bunch of people were killed. But Del Dunmeyer purchased the property and then he had the house taken down, like razed. He donated the lot, the property itself, to the neighborhood association.
Before he donated it, he actually did a whole excavation on the lot to see if there were any other bodies or anything that they could recover. And then the lot was split between the two neighbors' houses. So now you just have two houses there next to each other, and there isn't an empty lot between the two because it's just 2 yards. So there's not very much left there.
But it just goes to show that there are people that care about the victims. And I would say Del Dunmeyer absolutely cared, and he did his best to take care of those families by doing what he did.
Yeah. There was a lot of what to do about Bob and Satanism and the occult, because it was said that they found a few books on witchcraft or Satanism in his house. Geraldo Rivera would come in and try to interview Bob Berdella, but Bob wouldn't get on camera. Geraldo would find witnesses or other people who would claim that they went to satanic rituals and Bob was sitting at a throne, or they went to Bob's house and watched him sacrifice whatever. This was the whole satanic panic, and Geraldo Rivera was holding that, you know, cross and declaring that there was a problem. The investigators were very upset by this. Bob was actually amused by it because they all knew that there was nothing related to the occult or Satanism. Bob had these books because that's what you sell at oddity shops. You sell these things that people consider to be odd, but they're just books on witchcraft or Wiccan books, things like that.
Bob was actually raised Catholic. The way I understand it is his father died when he was just 16. His mother remarried. He was not happy with who she married. He wasn't happy she got married again. It's said that he went and prayed, but religion offered him no answers and no comfort. And that's when he started dabbling in other religions like the occult. But as we've discovered, it's not like he started to believe in another religion. He didn't stay Catholic, obviously, but I think he just pretty much gave up on religion, period. And as Justin said, when you have an oddity shop, you need weird items.
Yeah. Even Bob would comment on the Geraldo Rivera piece and make statements saying that this has nothing to do with the occult. This has nothing to do with anything such as that. He would also decry the radio DJs and radio stations that wrote songs about him and made the jokes about him. He would say that the media dehumanized him as much as he dehumanized his victims. That's ironic.
Well, it's almost like he's saying two wrongs don't make a right.
Yeah. Like anyone has any sympathy for him. He will be sentenced to multiple life sentences in 1988, but he will avoid the death penalty. He dies in 1992, just a short 4 years later, of a heart attack while in prison. He was kept in segregation away from the other prisoners. He would have unruly demands while he was in prison. There was claims that it cost a lot of additional money to keep him imprisoned, and the public was not happy about that because they separated him from general population. He would contact Reverend Coleman and say that they're not treating him well, they're not feeding him, that the guards would try to persuade other prisoners to attack him. And he actually tells the Reverend that they're withholding his heart medication right before the time of his death. There is a conspiracy now that the guards intentionally did this so he would die. He was actually in decent health. He was doing okay before he went to prison. I don't know. I don't disbelieve this conspiracy, but prison can be hard on you, and I don't know. It's just odd. What do you think, Aaron?
I'm not sure most people care to even discover the truth of this answer.
No.
You know, of this question, because they don't care. They just, if he's dead, fine. He's a waste of space anyway. It's the kind of conspiracy that people are okay with.
Absolutely.
It couldn't have happened to a worse guy. Because these families didn't have bodies to bury, obviously two of the families had skulls. How do you put remains to rest when you don't have them? Robert Sheldon's family, their plans were originally to have a service in California. Because of what happened to their son had happened to other families, they decided to have a memorial service in Raytown at the Spring Valley Baptist Church. And they were very much thinking of these other families. In fact, the parents of James Ferris and Gerald Howell were present at this service. I suppose also they wanted to let people know what happened. It was their way to say goodbye to their family members. That was on April 15th, 1989, which was a Saturday. Early on, we talked about how Jeffrey Dahmer sort of stole the headlines away from Bob Rodella. And obviously, Dahmer is a big name when it comes to serial killers because he ate his victims. But as you pointed out, Burdella was torturing living victims, dehumanizing them, putting them through hell. I still don't understand how Dahmer is a bigger name. I know we can talk about it. We can say this is what they say, but I don't get it.
I don't know. One day I was called to figure out the authenticity of one of his business cards that some people were selling, and they figured, what's called Justin? He would know. I was able to actually authenticate it and figure out what it was, but when it came to the price, they were trying to see how much do you think this is worth? And I said, well, are you selling it to somebody in Kansas City or are you selling it to somebody out in the world? Because here in Kansas City, he's infamous, but anywhere else, he's sort of a C-list serial killer. Nobody knows about him. Not that there's A-list and all that, but it's just he's a lesser known guy. And I rank him up there with Robert Pickton and some of the more gruesome serial killers. Jeffrey Dahmer was horrendous, but I don't really think there's a comparison here.
Getting to the why of Bob Rodella, why did he do this? I'm really at a loss. I don't know, because if you look at where he came from a Catholic family, talked about his dad dying, his mother remarrying. Bob got into some trouble in school. He was selling drugs. He went to the Kansas City Art Institute, and not really sure why he got into art, but maybe it's related to his Bob's Bizarre Bazaar shop. He had an interest in artifacts, exotic things from around the world. But he was arrested back when he was going to the Art Institute for marijuana and methamphetamines, but his sentence was suspended. He gets kicked out for killing a dog for art. And he had committed animal abuse. He had tortured a duck and a chicken before he had drugged and killed the dog.
He also made a maze when he was younger, and he would hand people a chick, baby chicken, and they would go through the maze, and when they got to the end, they would see a video where he would shoot a chick with a shotgun and it would explode. And this would startle them so bad that they would squeeze the chick in their hand and kill it. This is disgusting. This is art to him.
But I don't see anything in his past that says, oh yeah, he's going to become a serial killer.
He was a cook and he was a short order cook at many different restaurants. And he alleges that he was sexually assaulted at one of these restaurants by a coworker. I don't know if I believe him or not. And this actually was later on, not during his childhood. So he was already on his way to being a sick individual. Not to say that this wouldn't have an effect on him. I think he had a normal childhood. I think he had a fairly normal life. People have their parents die. People go to college and they do drugs. These are normal things. This is nothing out of the ordinary. Unlike, say, the shoemaker or some of the other people we've covered. I think this is a very nature, not nurture.
People that had interacted with Bob said that he seemed to have a real problem with women. I don't know if you can point back to when his mother remarried as perhaps a catalyst for that. I'm not sure we can totally understand what drove Bob Rodella to do what he did.
His own admission is he would help these younger men out and he would give them shelter, give them food, give them money. and they would cross him or they would not reciprocate. He felt that they were all leeches. This was his way of getting back at some of them, or getting back at all of them, was by controlling them, by capturing them and owning them. That's the closest explanation we get from him.
Right. And resentment is a theory that people have regarding Bob Rodella. I'm not sure it's a strong argument, but they say that when he was a child, he had to wear these thick glasses and that other kids would tease him. It just seems, at least to me, it seems incomplete. That doesn't explain the amount of terror and pain that he inflicted on his victims.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.